Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all. Many I recognize and some I don't. Thank you very much, Master Sido, for inviting me here. Lovely to be back again in Telford. Mr. Peter, hi. Good to see you. For those of you who do not know who the good Reverend here is, this is Reverend Hugh. Reverend Hugh Gould. He is my disciple and fellow mischief maker at the Fugain Forest Hermitage. And he's traveling with me in Europe these 5 months to visit our various temples and get to know our Sangha better. Since Reverend Master Sido has invited me to speak with you all, I thought perhaps what I would do would be to offer you a Dharma talk, and then over cups of tea, we can talk about things generally, anything and everything, whether it be related to the Dharma talk or not, and then I understand that there is a lovely lunch awaiting. Ooh, lots of lovely lunch, all the better. The talk I thought I would give this morning centers around one of the steps, one of the aspects of the Eightfold Path. But it's one that's a bit neglected in terms of Dharma talks, or at least as far as I can remember. There's just not all that much said about it or written about it, and that is right livelihood. Now, it really is one of the eight steps, so the Buddha must have thought that this was a very important thing. And if you reflect for just a moment, goodness, from our school days to retirement and thereafter, we spend a lot of our time in livelihood. So this must be an area where the practice, the training of Buddhism, can have significant influence. And I think one of the reasons it's not talked about an awful lot is that at its most basic level, the teachings on right livelihood are actually quite simple and easy to apply, which is wonderful. The Buddha basically spoke of right livelihood in terms of avoiding wrong livelihood. And traditionally, there were five types of wrong livelihood to avoid. The manufacture or trade in weapons and armaments, the manufacture or trade in intoxicants, manufacture or trade in poisons, the trade in human beings, such as for slavery, prostitution, and the like, and the raising of or trade in animals for slaughter. Fair enough. These are pretty clear-cut. They're actually pretty easy for most Buddhists to avoid, at least at their gross and obvious level. Now, having said that, in one sense, one could stop. But let's not. Let's go on a bit more. I see two ways of proceeding from here. One is to take those five wrong livelihoods and look a bit more closely at each of them to see their more subtle level. That is the way I am not going to go this morning. It's an excellent way to go, and at other times I have gone in that direction with folks. And I recommend it to you to consider on your own. As soon as you start looking at those five wrong livelihoods in their more subtle forms, the whole business gets a lot more murky. But that's good, because it brings up important ethical questions. For instance, to give an example of that approach to it. Suppose you own shares in a mutual fund or holding company which itself owns shares in one company out of 100 that it owns shares in that makes computer programs that someone else uses to design guidance systems that someone else puts into missiles. Now, are you indirectly trading in weapons and arms, or are you not? Good question. I look at that sort of question, and I know a lot of folks do. And it's a good question to look at. There are no easy answers to these kinds of questions. There is no simple formula that I know of that can be applied easily. All I can recommend is use individual conscience, use your best awareness and wise discernment, and use a certain amount of common sense. And somehow I think one threads one's way between two opposites here. The opposite of uncaring, selfish indifference on the one hand, and the opposite of such scrupulous detail that one is paralyzed from doing anything on the other. Sure, Master Jiyu, our founder, used to call this latter opposite the centipede with washing up cloths. Imagine a centipede with 100 arms and legs, each with a washing up cloth, trying to clean everything so much that it can't move. Okay? There is that opposite to consider avoiding. So you have to use a certain amount of common sense. And somewhere between the opposite of that and crass indifference lies a broad middle way. And different people are going to make different decisions about where within that middle ground they feel comfortable being in terms of right livelihood. And I certainly respect that. There is room for Buddhists to differ in that area. So I recommend that approach to you. Consider those five in their subtle levels. But this morning, I'm going to take a different approach. And that is that I'm going to rejoice in the fact that, at least on the gross level, it's relatively easy to avoid wrong livelihood. Because that means that most work that we do is or can be right livelihood. And that allows us to take it deeper in a different way. How can we make the most, in terms of right livelihood, of what we are doing? Now, Dogen Zenji, the 13th century Zen master who brought Soto Zen from China to Japan, spoke of right livelihood as an act of charity. Now, charity is one of the four bodhisattva acts, one of the four wisdoms or signs of enlightenment. Let me quote you two things he said about this. Well, first from the Shushogi. It is an act of charity to build a ferry or a bridge, and all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. And from his chapter in the Shobogenzo known as Bodhisattva Shishobo, earning a living and doing productive work have never been anything other than an offering of alms. Now let's look at those two statements more closely. An offering of alms. So he's saying here that right livelihood is an offering. And I find that a revolutionary view, a very freeing view, because it immediately reverses the view we were all taught by our culture and society, that right livelihood, or that livelihood generally, was a means to an end. Okay? You go to work so that you can X, Y, Z, whether that be support your family, do good for the world, whatever it may be. You go to work in order to do something. Dogen is here offering the possibility of reversing that and saying the work itself is an offering. Assuming that the ends are anywhere reasonably beneficial, it's the work itself has something about it which may be beneficial in and of itself, irrespective of the ends. And that means that it's possible to do right livelihood at each moment by asking oneself, what offering can I make in this situation that faces me right now, at work, at school, wherever you might be, in your livelihood? How can I make an offering here? What offering can I make here? And that brings us pretty close to our founder, Reverend Master Jiyu's statement, or actually it was her master's statement to her, that when faced with difficulties, do the best you can. Now that's a very slippery statement, because when you first hear it, and when she first heard it, she thought, oh, he's just telling me, eh, do the best you can and then let it slide. Oh no, not at all. Well, then she realized that isn't what he meant. So then she went to the other opposite. Oh my dear heavens, I've got to do the best possible job of everything, no matter what the cost to me or anyone else. No, that didn't work either. That's not what he meant. What he meant, what she meant, is in the situation that you find yourself in, do the best you can with what is available to you in the wide sense. Best in the wide sense, accepting the entire situation, including your own limitations, the limitations of the situation, the fact that you need to keep going and you're here for the long haul, you don't want to kill yourself in one situation or you'll be of no good in another, burn yourself out. Best is a very wide term, a very long range term. And she's saying there, to the extent you, to whatever extent you realize the potentials of this situation, make the highest offering of that situation and let that be enough. And if you later find that there was more that you could have done or that you now can do, fine, then do more. But let the best you are aware of in this situation be sufficient, for it is sufficient. That's all Buddhism ever asks of us. It does not ask us to be supermen, superwomen. It asks us simply to do the honest best we know. And that is highly similar to Dogen's statements about right livelihood being an offering. Now note that he also says, if they benefit others. So, obviously, right livelihood is not for ourselves alone. And I think that's clear to most of us. He says something else, however, about this benefit to other beings. Also from the Bodhisattva Shishobo. It is of no concern if offerings are large or small. The important point is whether they benefit other beings. So, on the simple level, he's saying, right, the livelihood that we do is of importance not because of the pay we get or the social status it has, but in the spiritual sense, its importance is that it benefits beings, somewhere. On a more subtle level, he's also saying, the benefit to other beings also is not measured, just that it benefits beings, not how much it benefits which beings, just that there is benefit, some benefit somewhere. So in that sense, he's inviting us not to get overly concerned with how much the benefit is, and trying to assess that and measure it or measure the merit that we get from our livelihood, but simply to see if there is some benefit. And that benefit is sufficient for it to be right livelihood. Now, in what ways might our livelihood benefit others? A lot of the ways are obvious. Again, this is a lovely area to talk about or to think about, because a lot of it is obvious. Many of us have occupations, professions that just obviously benefit people. Great. But some are not obvious. Are there other kinds of benefit that can occur? Oh, yes, there are. Even if the object that you produce, let's say, or the product that you produce, or the service that you provide, even if it isn't obvious to you that that has a benefit, then consider two other things. One is simply to look a little more deeply at ways in which it may benefit others. The other is to look at the fact that making an honest offering itself benefits others, i.e., doing the best you can in these various situations that you find at work, at school. Making that honest offering itself is of benefit. He's saying here, don't focus exclusively on the product, on the ends. Look at the how. Look at the means as well. Again from Bodhisattva Shishomo. It is hard to turn around the hearts and minds of others. By coming up with one offering, we begin to turn their mental state around, after which we hope it will continue to turn around until they attain the way. Thus, right livelihood involves not just material offerings, but the offering of Dharma, the offering of our own training in our work situation. Do not underestimate the teaching effect you have on others around you just by bringing to bear your own Buddhist training, all quietly and without any fuss, to your work situation. We think often, oh, great, you know, I mean, my goodness, me, I'm just a new Buddhist. I mean, you know, he's talking about me being a teacher. Uh-huh, you are. Guess what? You all are. And you don't have a choice about that, because people are watching, and people are not dumb. They are aware of what you're doing, and they sense things. Even if they've never talked about Buddhism, they sense your being and how you approach things. So the question really is not whether you are a teacher, but it is what you are going to teach today. And I must admit, I found that rather sobering when I realized that. Oh, I can't really hide. None of you can. It's impossible. Your Buddhism, your practice, your training, your honest efforts to make offerings, are going to have effects on others. And that is a wonderful thing. And when you lose sight of your training and get into a bit of a state and do things you later regret, well, that has effects too. So that was your, that unfortunately was the teaching you offered that day. So it matters. The teaching you offer by being and how you are is a big part of this offering of right livelihood. Now, saying that right livelihood benefits others does not say that it cannot also benefit self. Okay? Again, that's a fairly obvious thing to say, but sometimes one has to say the obvious, because one can get so wrapped up in the side of benefiting others that one tends to forget the self. And it is excellent to be concerned with the benefit of others. And by the way, when I say others, I'm not just talking about people. I'm talking about all living creatures. I'm talking about the earth. Benefit taken widely. But don't forget, there's one living creature that often gets ignored, and that's you. That's part of beings, too. Rinmaster Jiu, speaking of this in Roar of the Tigress, says, "Do not despise any occupation. All is the work of a Buddha, especially if it is offered for the benefit of other people as well as self." He's saying exactly what Dogen's saying. Offered benefit of other people as well as self, she adds. You must never cut self out of this, by the way. We train for self and other. And when we remember that, and it's sometimes difficult, remember that self is in there along with other. By accepting the self part, then we make a step in accepting what is. And it's a little bit harder to cling on to ideals and opinions about how it ought to be. I can remember, I think, one of the times that I had the most distress in my monastic training as a young monk was when, I am a dyed-in-the-wool idealist, horrible at it. It's been a struggle for me for a long time. You know, trying to accept what is, right? You know, there were all these, ideals floating around, buzzing upstairs here. Red Master Gia walked past me on the cloister. I was obvious, I don't know how she knew I was buzzing with an ideal of some sort or another. And she just sort of casually said, "You do realize, don't you, Vaisley, that ideals are just another form of delusion?" And then she walked on down the cloister. but my ideals! And I gradually learned, yeah, she was right. There's nothing wrong with them as statements of what I, well, I was going to say what I want to be. Actually, what I think I want to be, because sometimes when you get what you want, it doesn't turn out to be what's really very great. As a statement of what I think I want to be, an ideal is fine. But that's usually not how serious idealists like me take it. We take it as statements of how it is or ought to be. And then we go busily go around the world trying to force the world to behave itself, or forcing ourselves to behave ourselves, to make us fit this mold. Well, if one can drop that and accept things a little bit more the way they are, then instead of this forcing, you see all these little opportunities to be of benefit. And some of those may lead in the direction of your ideals. Some of them may lead in totally new directions. But you can move. You can actually benefit situations a lot more without all the stuff buzzing around in your head. So accepting that livelihood is for self as well as for others can be difficult if you're an idealist, but it can be very useful for this reason. And Dogen adds an interesting little twist to this, again from Bodhisattva Shishobo. When we have learned well what the offering of alms means, the accepting of oneself and the letting go of oneself are offerings. Nicely brings it back, right back around. When we learn well what the offering of alms really means, two big ones are self-acceptance and letting go of the self. And the self includes all of the opinions, ideals, and the like. So in these ways, looked at as an offering of benefit to both self and other, right livelihood has some deeper aspects and some positive aspects that you can consider, more than simply avoiding wrong livelihood acts. Okay, now as general principles, that's all well and good, but how does one do that? Well, obviously, we each have very different situations that we're in. And so we're going to come up with different ways that are suitable to our particular livelihoods. Let me give you a couple of examples from the classical Buddhist text of right livelihoods, and also some of classical advice on the question of right livelihood. I will start with the example of layman Pang. Now, Pang Nyun lived in China in the 9th century. He was a sincere student of Zen, frequently visiting the local temples, as were his entire family, his wife, daughter, and son. He was not exceptionally rich, but he was a very successful businessman. So he was let's say, upper middle class, perhaps, by their standards. Although he was a successful businessman, unfortunately, he was also highly attached to being successful, and was known to be unusually stingy and abusive in his business practices. Well, as happens when one engages in Buddhist training over long periods of time, one day he woke up to the fact that he was not doing very well with this. This was not the way to be. And he woke up to it and was so horrified by the way he was that he loaded all of his money and valuables onto a boat, rowed out into the middle of the river, and dumped them. When asked why he didn't give them away to local charities and things, he said he dared not presume to burden others as he had been burdened. From that day onwards, he and his daughter made their livelihood by making cheap bamboo baskets and utensils, while his wife and son worked the small plot of land around the family home for food. Thus they freed themselves from their former encumbrances. And, lo and behold, they had time to visit numerous Zen masters and devote themselves to Zen practice much more than they ever had before. And in the end, each of them realized the way. Now, here's one of his comments. Actually, I'll give you two comments of Layman Pang on the issue of livelihood. Now, this first one is an interview he has with a Zen master. And I'll read you the interview and then explain a little bit about it, because it's one of those Zen things when you first read it. The layman had an interview one day with Chan Master Tatong Puchi. Holding up the bamboo basket in his hand. Now remember how he made his living. He made his living by making bamboo baskets. Holding up the bamboo basket in his hand, the layman cried, "Master Tatong, Master Tatong." The master made no response. Then the layman said, "When Shitu's doctrine reached you," now Shitu was Puchi's master, and both the layman and Puchi knew him. "When his doctrine reached you, ice melted and the tiles broke." "That is obvious without your mentioning it," replied Puchi. Throwing down his basket, the layman said, "Who'd have thought? It isn't worth a single coin." "Though it is not worth a single coin, how can one get along without it?" responded the master. The layman did a little dance of joy and started to leave. "Layman," called Puchi, holding up the basket. The layman turned his head. The master then did a dance of joy and left. "Ah, returning home," cried the layman, clapping his hands. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, as I see it, Layman Pang is holding up his offer. He makes baskets. He's holding up the offering of his livelihood to the master and saying, "What about this?" Now, the master's silence, silence generally means acceptance or recognition in the Sangha. Okay, it doesn't mean you're being ignored. It's kind of the opposite to the way things work in the West. Then the layman invites Puchi into making distinctions and comparisons. He sort of offers the Zen game to him to see if he'll play. By speaking of making the comparison between the wonderful things that happen as a result of the master's livelihood of being a monk and having the Dharma passed on to him with the worthlessness of his baskets, okay? But Master Puchi doesn't bite on the lure. He isn't going to play that game. Instead, he says, "Though it is not worth a single coin, how can one get along without it?" Okay? He's recognizing simultaneously its worthlessness and the worthlessness of all things in the usual sense of worthlessness and their immense value in the real sense. How can one get along without it? It is of inestimable value. This is your offering. And it is a basket of great worth. We need these. It is wonderful. And it is your offering. How can one get along without it? Layman Pang resonates with this and does a dance of joy at their mutual recognition of this truth. But he starts to leave without his basket. Puchi calls out to him, holding up the basket as if to say, "And don't forget your livelihood." This completes their interchange, and they both express their joy. Now here's another of Layman Pang's comments on right livelihood, this time in poetic form. "My daily activities are not unusual. I am just naturally in harmony with them, grasping nothing, discarding nothing. In every place, there is no hindrance, no conflict. Who is it that assigns imperial ranks, such as vermilion and purple gowns? The hills and mountains' last speck of dust is extinguished. Do you want to know what is supernatural power and marvelous activity? It is drawing water and carrying firewood." He's found that the simple activities of his life are what matter. that just doing the next thing is sufficient. His life and his livelihood are not complicated, they're not goal-oriented, they're not concerned with fame or gain or any of the things he used to be concerned with. But notice he also says there's no discarding anything. In other words, he's no longer throwing things into the river either. He's found a way to live beyond the opposites. And his life of livelihood and his life of training are one thing. They are seamless. They are not two. Now, in order to find that place, he needed to do something very radical. He took the family assets and dumped them in the river. And they were poor for the rest of their lives. Is that necessary? Was it necessary for him? We'll never know. Is it necessary for us? Is that what Daizui is recommending here? Well, let me give you another example. Let me give you the example of Anathapindika the Great. Anathapindika the Great was also known as Anathapindika, feeder of the poor. He lived at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha and was his chief supporter. He was said to be unswerving in keeping the precepts for householders, unstinting in his charity, not only to the Sangha, but also to the poor, and continuous in his practice of the Eightfold Path. He was and remained a successful merchant throughout his entire life. He had vast wealth and was said to support a household of over 500 retainers. He never failed to offer the Buddha and the Sangha food and lodging in his various parks and groves. On one occasion, his own parks were not large enough to accommodate the assembled Sangha, so he sought to rent the pleasure grove of the local prince, Prince Jetta. The prince did not particularly want to rent out his pleasure grove to a bunch of wandering mendicant monks, so he set a ridiculous price. He said that Anathapindika could rent the grove if he covered it with gold. To his horror, carts of gold soon started arriving, paving the park from one end to the other. But Anathapindika didn't have quite enough gold for the job, so he left to raise more cash to complete the job. Prince Jetta, seeing the magnitude of Anathapindika's acceptance and faith and charity, and being impressed with a teaching that could lead one to such a place, begged Anathapindika to bring no more gold, so that the final part of the park could be his, Jetta's, offering to the Sangha. And many of the sutras start with these words. Once the Blessed One was staying in Savatthi, in Jetta's grove. So here we have an example of someone who found that he could continue a very busy livelihood, a very successful and lucrative livelihood, without attachment to it. And he turned both its practices and its fruits to the good of beings. And by the way, the beings he turned who have benefited from his practice includes you and me, because of those sutras that the Buddha was able to speak to the multitudes in Prince Jetta's grove that Anathapindika had rented for him. Never underestimate the long-term effects of right livelihood. It was not necessary for Anathapindika to throw away anything. What he did was simply to take the Buddha's teaching to heart and practice it as earnestly as possible. Again, his life and his livelihood became seamless with his training. It is said by the Buddha that by the end of his life, Anathapindika had realized the fruits of a stream enterer and also possessed the right knowledge and right liberation usually found only amongst the arahants. At his death, he was reborn in the Tushita heaven, from which he continued to visit the Buddha as a deva, inquiring for further instructions for practice. Okay. Now, I deliberately took those two as examples because the form of their approach to right livelihood couldn't be more different. But look beyond the form to the essence of it. Both of them found a way to make a life of offerings. Both of them found a way to make their livelihood at one with their practice. Both showed great sincerity in their training and non-attachment to fame, gain, goals, conventional expectations, and the like. Both accepted their circumstances as they arose and responded to them by just doing the next thing that needed to be done. And the forms that these took were radically different for these two. The merit of just doing the next thing without attachment is one which I think merits a bit more commenting on. Because this also is an entrance to how one can do right livelihood. Let me read you some advice that Zen Master Bankei, a 17th century Japanese master, gave on this point. A farmer came to the master and asked him how he might remain in harmony with the unborn Buddha mind when his mind was frequently distracted by angry thoughts. The master said, "Since the unborn Buddha mind is something that you and everyone else are born with, there is no way you can go about attaining it now for the first time. Just attend to your farm work and have no other thoughts. That is the working of the unborn mind. Now, you can swing your hoe while you're angry too, for that matter, but in that case your work becomes hard and onerous. When you hoe with a mind unclouded by anger and all other such things, the work is easy and pleasant. It is the practice of the Buddha mind itself. It is unborn and undying." We can hoe or compute or study our lessons or drive our truck or whatever it may be, with a mind clouded, preoccupied, worried, distracted. In which case, benefits do still occur, don't doubt that. But not near the benefits that occur when you can drop, even for a moment, those distractions, those worries, those preoccupations, and just hoe, drive, plant, study. With a mind of simply doing the next thing, wholeheartedly making an offering of your study, of your planting, of your hoeing, of your driving. And what Zenkei is saying is, oh, there's more to that than you know. That is the operation of the Buddha mind itself. It's not that the Buddha mind isn't there when you're distracted and worried and angry and all those other things, but you're piling stuff on it, you're burying it. This is another reason for making livelihood seamless with our practice. Our Buddhist practice over the course of long periods of time makes it a little easier to drop off attachments of various kinds, such as worry and anger and distraction, and allow for simply hoeing, simply doing the next thing. This again is in the context of assuming that this is that one's hoeing or driving or whatever is in basically an area of right livelihood, i.e. not wrong livelihood. But that's once that is established, and it's pretty easy to establish, then you don't have to be constantly worried about that side of it. You can just do the next thing. Finally, know that you can practice right livelihood anywhere, at all times. It doesn't require a specific occupation. It doesn't require that the conditions at work have to be just so. We tend to get wrapped up in trying to fix everything, get it just right, and then we can train during our work situation. Well, it doesn't really work that way very well. Look at it from the point of view of offerings. What offering can I make right now? Yes, all sorts of things might be better in some sense if things were different around here, but They aren't. What can I do right now? On this topic, hear the words of Master Su Yun. He was perhaps the most famous Chan master, or Chinese Zen master, of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He said as follows, those who really apply their minds to training do not discriminate between the mutable and the immutable, or against any kind of daily activity. They can do it, i.e. training, while in the street, at the noisy marketplace, anywhere they may happen to be. Formerly, there was a monk who called on learned masters for instruction. One day he arrived at a marketplace and passed a butcher's shop, where every buyer was clamoring to the butcher, insisting on having pure meat. Suddenly the butcher got angry, and putting down his chopper, asked them, "Which piece of meat is not pure?" Upon hearing this, the monk was instantaneously enlightened. Ask yourself, then, which moment is not an opportunity for right livelihood? Which honest offering that you make is not a Buddha act?
Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.